So, now you know where the real power lies in this church. Anybody who preaches here has to rehearse their talk privately to Roberto the Friday beforehand. And then he'll tell you if it's good enough to go in public. So I'm going to come a little bit nearer. Just before I do anything else, I just want a couple of thank yous. Firstly, thank you to all the church family who took part in that amazing idea of taking our Christmas cards around the parish last week. Anybody here did some of that? It was good fun, wasn't it? You enjoyed it. Thank you for the feedback we've had. We think we've cracked doing that for future years. Pray for good weather for next time. We've got about half a dozen bundles left, and they're at the back. And if I think they're all in the streets just to the left of the church, so within a very short walk. So if anybody is willing to do that on a lovely day like today, please do grab those at the end. Secondly, I'd love to thank those who organised the Artisans Market. Did anybody come to the Artisans Market yesterday? Amazing. Does anybody know how many people we had through the doors? Who was doing the count? Helena. 897 people through the door. That is over double last year. Helena had the idea. Let's give Helena a round of applause for that idea. This is the third year we've turned this church, for those who weren't here. It's basically turned into an indoor market. It's a bit like going back to the good old days of the medieval church, where all the community events happened within or around the local church. When you think of it, nearly every community in the UK, the biggest publicly available indoor space is the parish church. And so often it's open for, 1 hour a week? And here we want to see more and more use. So thank you, Helena, for the idea. And clearly that is growing. So we're delighted with that. And we'll have even more through next year, I'm sure. So thank you for those two things. And then just the other thing I need to do is publish some Banns of Marriage. Is anybody here to hear their Banns of Marriage read? No, you're too young. That can't be. But it's good that you've got it in mind. So, I published the Banns of Marriage between Jonathan Peter Shaw and Sarah Elizabeth Moran, and between George Mackay and Alice Elizabeth Rollin, all of this parish. Today, these banns are published for the third time of asking. If anyone present knows reason in law why they may not marry, you are to declare it now. Okay, let's pray for them. Father, will your blessing rest upon Jonathan and Sarah, George and Alice, as they prepare for their weddings in the next few weeks. Pray for all the last-minute preparations. But above all, we pray that through their love and through the celebration of that big day, your love will become clearer and clearer to them. For we ask it in Jesus' name. Amen. Okay, a little bit of introduction to what we're doing. We're starting a teaching program or a teaching arc that will take us through to the summer. We're looking at foundations and freedoms. And next week, there will be a card that will detail the teaching of the church right the way through to July next year. You'll be able to pick that up. And you'll see that we're doing some teaching in blocks. We're working with small group leaders to make sure that the material can be worked through. You know, the language we're using of those of us who teach are planting seed in our small groups and other ways. We water that seed, but we know that it's God who gives the growth. And we look to him to grow us as we create an environment in which he can grow things. So I'll say a little bit more just about the teaching arc. Inevitably, because the 10 is slightly different to the 5 in structure, we have things like the annual meeting. We have whole church, all age gatherings as well that the 5 doesn't. There will be times when we at the 10 will need maybe to catch up on some of the teaching given at the 5. And we'll make that clear when that's the case. So we started with a 3-week series at the 5, only one of which Chris gave here at the 10, called The Language of Growth, talking about responsibility. What is our responsibility? Our dependability, what we depend on, and our leadability, who's leading us. And the two people who gave that teaching, Chris and Andrew at the 5, by the end of this week, there'll be a video encapsulating that teaching. We'll send out the link to everybody so that you can catch up, because that's foundational. And then at the moment, we're in a short series on fathering and forgiveness, a foundational truth of understanding that God is a good father. And particularly discovering that freedom in part comes through our ability to forgive others. And that conversely, if we will not forgive, if we withhold forgiveness, we then remain ourselves unfree. So that's really the thrust of this morning. And I want to approach it through a famous story that Jesus told. Now, if you know me well, you'll know that one of my real concerns is not to make assumptions about what people know when they're in a church gathering. Some of you wouldn't even claim to be Christian here this morning. Some of you are beginning that journey. So I don't like making presumptions about what people know. But I'm going to slightly break my own rule this morning and assume a certain level of awareness in many people on the story which we call the parable of the prodigal son. Now, if you're not familiar with it, please don't worry. You won't be disadvantaged because you'll see what happens. So I want to just explain the story of the prodigal son, man with two sons, younger son gets fed up, waiting for his inheritance. He reckons he can have a much better life elsewhere. So he gets his dad to break up the estate, to give him his part of the proceeds, and he heads off to a far-off country where it all goes spectacularly wrong. Bad investments, bad choices, bad lifestyle, and he ends up in poverty. Okay, so that's the scenario. I want to pick up the reading in verse 17, but I'm reading from a slightly different translation. So here we go. Slightly old-fashioned. At last he cometh to his senses and saith, all my father's hired workers have more than they can eat, and here I am about to starve. I will arise and go to my father and say, Father, I have sinned against heaven and before thee. I am no longer worthy to be called thy son. Make me as one of thy hired servants. So he arose and came to his father. But when he was still a long way off, his father seeth him and runneth to him and falleth on his neck and pulleth his hair and smacketh his backside and clumpeth him on the ear and saith, where the devil dost thou think thou have been, scumbag? And the prodigal replieth, Father, I have sinned against heaven and before thee. I am no longer worthy to be called thy son. Make me as one of thine hired servants. The father saith, too right I'll make thee as one of my hired servants. Master dirty stop out inheritance spending stinker pinker prodigal. I suppose thou believest that thou canst waltz back in here without so much as a by thine leave and conneth me with thine dramatic little speech. Thinkest thou that this is Little House on the Prairie? Or mayhap thou reckoneth that I was born yestere'en? Oh no, third assistant bog cleaner unpaid for thee, my odorous ex-relative. Then the prodigal saith dismally unto him, oh, right, fair enough. So just to get it straight, there existeth no question of lots of nice presents and instant forgiveness, an enlarged celebratory meal involving the fatted calf or anything of that nature. In thy dream, son, replieth the father, the only gift thou art likely to see is the personalized lavatory brush with which thou shalt shortly be presented. Get thee to work, thou less than baldric, and think thyself lucky. And the father taketh the prodigal son by the ear which previously he clumpeth, and hauleth him back to the farm. And behold, as nightfall approacheth, the prodigal's elder brother heareth distant sounds as of an bog brush being applied, and strolleth out to the edge of the cesspit after supper, holding an enlarged brandy. And he stretcheth luxuriously, and picketh his teeth, and lighteth an enormous cigar, and looketh down, and saith, evening, Rambo, I see thou hast returned then. Likest thou thine rapid progress from affluent to effluent? And the prodigal looketh up, and saith, verily thou rebukest me justly with thine clever barb. When I had great wealth, I shared it not with thee, but now I freely offer thee and good share of what is mine. And he flicketh at the elder brother with his brush, so that an weighty portion of something exceeding unpleasant ploppeth into his brother's brandy glass. And his brother retireth, threatening to tell on him. And lo, the fatted calf rejoiceth greatly. Many thanks to Adrian Plass. Many of you will recognize his hand in that. Apologies to him for slightly altering it, but it's a great take on that famous story. I just want to pose the question about the title. You know, throughout the ages, for many, many years, for at least 1,000 years, The story has been known as the story of the prodigal son. But actually, it could be the story of the lost son or the lost sons, because as we shall see, both sons are actually lost. It's one of the slightly sobering aspects of the story that you can be just as lost on the family farm as you can in the far-off country. But given that the word prodigal means wasteful, and as we shall see, the father's crazy, extravagant love and grace and forgiveness, it could be called the story of the prodigal father. But it's interesting that Jesus gives it no title. Jesus just introduces it in verse 11 of Luke 15. There was a father who had two sons. In other words, as far as Jesus is concerned, this is a story about three people. It is as much about the elder son as it is about the younger, and it's as much about the father as it is about either of them. And so our title, which always focuses down on just one character in this three-part drama, is going to miss some of the glorious truth that we have for us. So Lucy is going to come up and read the non-Adrian Plass version, just so that we hear the words that Jesus actually spoke. And as we read this, and as I move on, I'm just wanting to pose three questions to you. What is your relationship to God as Father? Secondly, what is your experience of the Father's forgiveness? And thirdly, what does your forgiveness look like? In other words, when you forgive, I'll assume charitably for the moment that you do, but when you forgive, what does your forgiveness look like? So we're going to have the reading, hopefully on the screens, and Bibles are coming round if you would like one.
So the reading comes from the 15th chapter of Luke, verses 11 to 32, and if you're using a church Bible, it's on page 1049. The parable of the lost son. Jesus continued, "There was a man who had two sons. The younger one said to his father, 'Father, give me my share of the estate.' So he divided his property between them. Not long after that, the younger son got together all he had, set off for a distant country, and there squandered his wealth in wild living. After he had spent everything, there was a severe famine in that whole country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to a citizen of that country, who sent him to his fields to feed pigs. He longed to fill his stomach with the pods that the pigs were eating, but no one gave him anything. And when he came to his senses, he said, 'How many of my father's hired servants have food to spare? And here I am, starving to death. I will set out and go back to my father and say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired servants.' So he got up and went to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him. He ran to his son, threw his arms around him and kissed him. The son said to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son.' But the father said to his servants, 'Quick, bring the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. Bring the fattened calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and celebrate. For this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found.' So they began to celebrate. And meanwhile, the older son was in the field, and when he came near the house, he heard music and dancing. So he called one of the servants and asked him what was going on. Your brother has come, he replied, and your father has killed the fattened calf because he has him back safe and sound. Then the older brother became angry and refused to go in. So his father went out and pleaded with him. But he answered his father, Look, all these years I've been slaving for you and never disobeyed your orders. Yet you never gave me even a young goat so I could celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours, who has squandered your property with prostitutes, comes home, you kill the fattened calf for him. My son, the father said, you are always with me, and everything I have is yours. But we had to celebrate and be glad, because this brother of yours was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found. And this is the word of the Lord.
Thanks, Lucy. So the first question, what is your relationship to God the Father? And in this passage, we're actually given a number of possible categories. And as we work through these, I want you to think of them not literally so much as the spirit in which you approach God as Father. The spirit in which you approach God as Father. What of these characterizes the way that you think of your discipleship, your relationship with God, your Christian walk? And the first is straightforward. It's right at the beginning in verse 11, son. And here Jesus uses the standard word in Greek for son. Let's say it together. Huios, after three. One, two, three. Huios. Okay. And that has a number of meanings. It means a son, either by birth or adoption. And one of the things we saw in the first sermon I did on this subject is that Christians are children of God by adoption, not by birth. By rebirth, yes, but not by birth. That's a really important thing. We're adopted into the Father's family. Secondly, it emphasizes the likeness of the Son to the Father. That phrase, a chip off the old block. We are supposed to be a chip off the old block. And as Jesus was a carpenter, that all works together rather well. And it highlights the legal right to the Father's inheritance. It was one of the extraordinary things about Greco-Roman law that a son adopted instantly had exactly the same inheritance rights as the son born biologically. Pauline New Testament theology translates that to say that Jesus is the only begotten son of the Father. Through adoption, all Christians instantly inherit everything he does. That's what Paul tells us with his application of Greco-Roman law on adoption, that if you are a Christian here, if you've put your faith in Jesus Christ, you inherit what Jesus inherits. That's why Paul can talk about us sharing all the riches of the Father. It's why the New Testament can talk us about sharing the glory of the Father, because we have the legal right to inherit. So that's fairly straightforward. Huios, son. So is that the spirit in which you relate to God? That sense of security, of knowing that as an adopted son, you are becoming more like him. You have the ability, because of his spirit, to become like him, to resemble him in nature. And particularly in terms of our long-term confidence in eternity, that you now stand to inherit everything that Jesus won on the cross. Is that your spirit? The spirit of sonship. And please don't get too worked up if you're not male here. Because actually, although it sounds bizarre to our ears, the fact that Jesus and Paul applied the male language of the Greco-Roman law, because it was only the son that would inherit, but because Jesus and Paul apply it universally to male and female, we don't understand quite how radically inclusive across the genders that was. We miss it today, but that's the reality. Whether you're male or female, you have all the rights equally to inherit with Jesus. Is that the spirit you approach? Now, I was fascinated as I started going through this parable afresh in Greek. New things come up. And I'd always assumed that when it gets to the bit where the son is at his lowest ebb and he hires himself out, that was the same word as is used later on about the father's hired servants. It's a logical thing because as you read it in verse 15, he, the younger son, went and hired himself out to a citizen of that country. But actually, the Greek word is different. It's a word kalao, so let's say that together. Kalao. Fantastic. You're doing great. Fantastic. And actually, it comes from the Greek for glue, and it means to bond. So it's the word used in Genesis, in the Greek translation of Genesis, that in marriage, a man shall leave father and mother and cleave, glue to his wife, adhere to. It has the sense of a soul tie. And it's interesting, isn't it? What seems to be implied by this Greek word is that, and I'm applying this spiritually, because all human beings are born bearing the image of God, and all human beings are born, according to the Song of Songs, with eternity in our hearts, or Augustine said, we are restless till we find our rest in you. Nicky Gumbel says, we all have a God-shaped hole at the center of our being. So there is a navigation system within the human spirit pointing us back to God. There is something in each one of us, male and female, that says, I was born to be the son of a king. And it seems, spiritually speaking, that if we have a disconnect with the one true father, if we have a disconnect with the one who really can save our souls, if we have a disconnect with the one who longs to be our father and to welcome us back, spiritually speaking, we will find another surrogate. It's fascinating to me the language that Jesus uses of what the son does. Bereft of his family, separated from his father, in a far-off country, he finds a surrogate, and he knits his soul to that soul. So it's worth just thinking for a moment, is that where some of us sit this morning? Have we responded to this desire to be fathered by a good God, missing that connection, and somehow knitting our soul somewhere else? So the son has two distinct elements. There are two others that I just want to look at briefly. The second is this hired servants in verse 17. It's the Greek word misthios. Again, misthios. You're almost fluent. I'm telling you, in a couple of weeks, we'll have you speaking Hebrew backwards. I mean, this is great the way we're going. No? Never mind. Misthios is a paid worker, a hired servant, and it is specifically contrasted with slave. Now, that's important. So we learn a couple of things. Within the context of the story, the people who work the father's estate are hired servants. They're not slaves. Please remember that, because it's going to be crucial for the next one. But they are hired servants. In other words, they're paid to do their work. Now, we can imagine what it might be like. There was a distinct difference in class in the Greco-Roman world between a servant and a slave. But being a servant was only a bit better than being a slave. Yes, you got paid. Yes, you got your board and lodging. You didn't wear anything on your feet. That will be significant a bit later. You went around barefoot. And basically, you had to do what you were told. And if you didn't do what you were told, there would be punishment. In other words, the relationship is a tenuous one. The relationship is dependent upon your good works. It depends upon you performing. It depends upon you coming up to scratch. It depends upon you doing what you should be doing. Because if you don't do it, there'll be other people who want the job. I have to say, in my pastoral ministry as a church leader, I've met a lot of people in the life of church, and that's the spirit that characterizes their relationship with the Father. It is as if they are a hireling or a paid servant. Their relationship is not as close as God wants it to be, and their understanding is that the only way they maintain their place is by what they do. And they're worried. It's why so many churches are full of people who are worried about doing things properly. Now don't get me wrong. We want to do things well. But if that spirit is at play, it's going to be a blockage between you and the Father. Does that make sense? Am I making sense with this? That spirit of the hireling. That actually I'm here on sufferance. I'm here as long as I continue to produce the goods. But woe betide me if I don't. Like Bob Dylan, trying to get to heaven before they close the door. The number of people I've sat with who have been in pews in churches for decades, and I talk to them about eternity, and they speak the language of anxious sort of hope. I hope I might get in. I hope I might have done enough. I hear this. I mean, in New Testament terms, it's unbelievable, but I hear it. Do you have the spirit of a hireling in your relationship to the God who doesn't want to be your boss, but wants to be your dad? And thirdly, that of slave. This is the elder son. And it's interesting that in church life, more people relate to the elder son than to the younger son. In the world out there, you meet a lot of people for whom the younger son is a very good picture of how they see themselves to be. They've wandered off. They can recognize the mess that life has become. And they're open to the story of the way home. But within the church, it's often the spirit of the elder son. And it's interesting, we already know from the story that the father doesn't have slaves, he has servants. And yet the elder son believes that he's a slave. It's the most poignant, terrible irony. All these years, I've been slaving for you. I believe those words are almost as wounding to the father as when the younger son says at the beginning of the parable, "Do you know what, Dad? I wish you were dead." Wounding words. The word is dual euo. Come on, let's give ourselves a treat. One more. Dual euo. Having all personal ownership rights assigned to the owner, to willingly give over the prerogative to be self-governing. Now, this is not the point of this sermon, but I don't want to mislead. In the New Testament, and in the language of Jesus, Jesus completely overturns the language of slavery and says, if you make yourself a slave to God, you will be freer than you can ever imagine. I'm not talking about that here. Okay, that is a theological truth, but we're not getting into that here. This is the slave spirit. The spirit of somebody who has all the possibilities of sonhood, all the rights, all the privileges, all the prerogatives, all the inheritance of the sonship, and yet thinks he's a slave. And again, I've met countless people in church life who, because they've put their faith in Jesus, have unlimited riches, but they're not aware of it, and they think of themselves as a slave. So what word most characterizes you? Are you a son? And is your soul knit correctly? Are you a hireling? Is that your spirit? I've got to do well enough. I've got to keep going. Jesus might be coming. Look busy. You know, that sort of thing. Or is it even worse, that of a slave? That resentment. And you can often tell people with that slave spirit because it's very hard for them to keep the bitterness inside. And we'll see that in a moment. Because my question now moves to forgiveness. Fatherhood is a foundational truth. Forgiveness is a matter of freedom. And I want to think about forgiveness. Not just what does your forgiveness look like, but have you experienced the forgiveness that we read about in this passage? Let's just think of the younger son for the moment and what he has to forgive. The younger son, as I just said, has basically said to him at this beginning, "Dad, I wish you were dead." Because the deal was this. Inheritance was land. And so to receive your inheritance, you had to wait till the landowner was dead. You didn't inherit until the father died. And in this scenario, with a father with two sons, the older son would have got 2/3 of the land, the younger son 1/3. That was the way it worked. So it's the most unconscionable insult to say, "I'm not prepared to wait for you to die. I wish you were dead now. Give me what's coming to me." It would have meant the breakup of the estate to release cash for the younger son to go and do what he wanted. And the agony for his father, mother's not mentioned, but let's include her, of not knowing what had happened when he's in the far country. And let's just look at the way the father responds. And as we look at this picture of forgiveness, I want you to have in your mind, does my forgiveness look like this? I'm assuming you forgive people. Okay, 2 nods. Tough crowd. Never mind. No. Does your forgiveness look like this? The first thing is that while he was still a long way off, the father sees him. Now, what's the only answer and explanation for the fact that the father saw him when he was a long way off? I'll cut to the quick. It's because he was watching. In this scenario, what does the fact the father was watching tell you about the father's heart? The father's heart was full of hope. I would imagine this man, I don't know what his life looked like, I don't know what his day-by-day stuff looked like, I don't know what time he had in his hands. I've just got this idea that maybe when his work was done, as the light was fading, as the gloaming was coming, he stood on the edge of the stake, maybe he walked the edge of the stake, straining his eyes in the direction in which the sun had left. Hope. Hope. So first question, when somebody makes their way to you for your forgiveness, is your posture already hoping that that's what they're going to do? Now, if you are sitting here right now this morning, you know that there's something between you and another person, maybe here, maybe on the other side of the world. What's your posture? Are you actually quite content never to see them again? Or are you straining, hoping that they're going to come for forgiveness? Secondly, having seen the younger son, the father runs to him. Now, this may sound bizarre. When you get to a certain age in the West, it just becomes impossible to run. In the ancient Near East, at any age of man, you did not run. It was one of the most undignified things you could do. Sounds bizarre? No wonder they were no good at tennis. But anyway, they just didn't do it. And yet this man does. As a picture of God, it tells us that God is more concerned with your thriving than he is with his reputation or dignity. Secondly, it tells us that God's desire for relationship with you is stronger than anything you can do to break that relationship. And I'm going to say that again, because as I've prepared this week, I think that phrase is significant for at least one person here, maybe more. God's desire for relationship with you is stronger than anything you can do to break that relationship. He runs, he embraces, he kisses. And then he calls for three things. He's filled with compassion and he runs. I love the way he cuts the liturgy short, maybe because I'm an Anglican. Do you notice that? That the son has, that didn't go down well, did it? The son has prepared his little speech. Father, I've sinned against heaven and before you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me as one of your hired servants. Doesn't get through it. Don't get through it. Father says, I'm not having that. You're back. That's a picture of God. And I wonder about me and I wonder about you. When somebody comes to ask forgiveness, you know, if it's a big deal, they will probably have been rehearsing what they're going to say to you for a long time, yeah? You've been in this situation. You've been in those situations where you know you've got to go and say sorry. You need somebody's forgiveness. And you practice the words. They keep you awake at night. And does your forgiveness look like the Father's forgiveness? Or are we those who rather savor what's coming? And we extract every moment of squirm from the other person we possibly can? Or do we cut short and get to the forgiveness? It's really important, I may say this again at the end, that forgiving does not mean saying to the other person, what you did doesn't matter. It matters a great deal. Way outside the context of what it's done to you and to the other person, it's nailed Jesus to the cross. It matters. But does our forgiveness look like the Father? The Father calls for three things: a robe, a ring, and sandals. All symbols of sonship and authority. But beyond that, they do three things, these robe, ring, and sandals. You imagine what the son is like as he arrives home. He spent we don't know how long working with pigs. Anybody ever smelt a pig farm? Anybody live near a pig farm? Anybody drive down the M5 when the pig farm wind is in the wrong direction? Yeah, this is not a nice smell. I'm amazed the story didn't say whilst he was still a long way off, the father smelt him. And then he's had all the travel home. We don't know how long, but it's a long way. He's an utter mess. And that external pig pen mess represents the chaos of the inner mess that is so often our human reality. And the father brings not just any robe, but the best robe. and he flings it around this mess. When God the Father wanted to redeem humankind, he didn't rummage around in the back of the cupboard for something that would do. He sent his only begotten Son. And this Father wraps his Son in the best robe. The first thing that the Father's forgiveness does is to cover his Son's squalor. And whatever squalor means to you, it's a tough word, I know, but whatever you think you've done, the Father just wants to cover it. He brings a ring, and that restores status. And the sandals, which only family wore, not the servants, assure him of his place. It's an amazing threefold gift of forgiveness. To cover your squalor, to restore your status, to assure you of your place. Does my forgiveness, does your forgiveness look like that? Do you cover over the mess that the other person has made? Do you assure them that their relationship with you is restored? Or will things always be a little rocky from now on? And do you assure them of their place in your life, in your affections? Jesus, in another story, said that when one person repents, the angels throw a party. And in this parable, Jesus tells us why, because that's what the Father does, and the angels copy him. And that's the Father's heart, is to throw a party. Is that what your forgiveness looks like? Because there is an alternative, if you're looking for a choice. And the alternative is the elder son, whose bitterness flows over, whose forgiveness is withheld, who cannot even bear the relationship he has with this man. Notice he doesn't say, my brother, this son of yours. Just hear the biting tone in which he says it, the venom, the lack of forgiveness. And his brother, the elder brother, is in prison. And that's why forgiveness is a freedom issue, because if we withhold forgiveness, not only do we fail to model what our Father has modeled to us. I mean, you think of what you and I have been forgiven. Think of everything in my life that was behind the force that drove the nails through the flesh of the Son of God. And Jesus forgave the lot. And if I withhold my forgiveness from someone else, not only am I failing to model what the Father and the Son modeled to me, but I'm confining myself to prison. That's what the Son does. Do you notice how the story ends? And this is why our focus, our relentless focus on the younger son, misses, for me, the greatest point in the parable. The story does not end with resolution. The party is in full swing. The younger son is restored. But neither the father nor the elder son, as far as we know, enter the party. The story ends with the father out in the darkness that the elder son has wrapped around himself with his bitterness and lack of forgiveness. And that's where we find the father beseeching the elder son to come in. You may have had, I've certainly had over the years, the question, how can a God of love send people to hell? My answer is simple. He never does. They're perfectly capable of sending themselves. And when they do, he follows and beseeches. What does your forgiveness look like? We're going to have an opportunity to just reflect on forgiveness and what our forgiveness looks like now. We've got a bit of time. We sent the kids down a bit late. They're rehearsing the nativity. Ruthie says they're good for a few extra minutes, so relax. We're going to use the Lord's Prayer together. I'll explain how we'll do that in a moment. We're going to use it. If you read the Lord's Prayer in Matthew 6, the words that Jesus says immediately after the Lord's Prayer are these. If you don't forgive others their sins, the Father can't forgive you yours. I don't believe that is a cause and effect, God waiting to punish you for slipping up. I think it just says something about the reality of the human heart and the human soul. That as we close, there is some way in which we're designed and built that if we close the door on forgiveness going out, it's the same door as the forgiveness that comes in. That's how I read that text. And it's a somber warning that Jesus gives us. Two things about forgiveness before we close. One is it does not mean that you're saying what was done to you doesn't matter. That's really important. And some of you will have stuff that is not going to be resolved now. And we've got a pastoral team who'd love to meet and pray with you at another time if that would help. Secondly, forgiveness does not depend on you feeling like forgiving. That trips a lot of people up. A lot of people think either I haven't forgiven or I can't forgive because I can't feel. Forgiveness is an act of the will. And you can decide to forgive, you can will to forgive, you can say to God, I am going to forgive. Don't feel like it. The truth is, with some stuff you may never feel entirely like it. But that need not stop you forgiving. So let's have the words of the Lord's Prayer on our screens. We're going to say it together. But I've arranged it in three parts. And the middle part is the part about forgiveness. And at that part, we're just going to pause and have a few minutes of quiet before we conclude the Lord's Prayer. Then we're going to sing again. And we'll come to a close. And if afterwards you'd like to pray with somebody, there will be people at the front. If, as I say, there's something and you know that you need to work on this, but you'll need help, then we've got a pastoral team who are willing to meet with you and begin accompanying you on that journey to forgiveness. So let's say these words together. Our Father in heaven, hallowed be your name. Your kingdom come. Your will be done on earth as in heaven. Give us today our daily bread. So let's just pause and remember. Let's go back. Let's go back to those first words. Let's remember what we've learned about Father. Let's remember what we've learned about his will being done, which is that forgiveness may flourish. Let's just think on that for a moment. So let's move on and say the next words. Let's just pause. Let's read them through. Maybe that we're already holding somebody in our mind. We know we need to forgive, to let go. But also a sense that we need to let ourselves out of the prison that unforgiveness keeps us in. So let's say this together. Forgive us our sins, as we forgive those who sin against us. In the quiet that follows, if there's anybody you need to forgive, very quietly in the private space within, just begin by talking to God about it, telling God that you want to do this, you will to do it, you desire to do it, however you feel, that actually you want to begin the journey of forgiveness.